Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hello all Happiness Is Egg Shaped listeners and watchers. This is the Happiness Is podcast with me, your host, Bruce Aitchison, brought to you in association with Infinity Blue. They can look after you whether it is a checkup, teeth whitening, or a more complicated procedure. Give them a call, get in touch, and they will look after you to make sure that you keep that smile intact. Because after all, they know, we know, I know, you know, happiness is egg shaped. Hello and welcome to the Happiness Is podcast with me, your host, Bruce Aitchison from Happiness Is Egg Shaped. And today I'm joined with an old friend, even though he's not that old. He's journeyed far and wide. I've absolutely loved watching what he's got up to, where he's got up to, and who he's got up to it with. This is a unique story and one that I've been very, very keen to hear about and to help tell. So let's not waste any time and bring in the one and the only, the more handsome than ever man, Andy Crammond. Hello, sir. How are you?
Very well, thank you. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good. It's good to see you. And you're back in Scotland. You've been away for a bit.
I have indeed. After 9 year stint in France, I've returned to the best city in the world, Edinburgh.
The best city in the world, Edinburgh. Now, you left the best city in the world, and it sounds like, if you believe some of the stories that we've heard, it sounds like It was all by chance and you didn't really think that it was a true story.
Yeah, well, that's quite right. Yeah, back to, well, it was during the under-20s. I suppose it was actually my first year of 20s when I went out to France for the 2013 World Cup, and I got a text message from a random number saying it's an agent, what are you up to next year? And I just presumed it was a joke from my roommate Adam Ash, so I just ignored it. And then I actually got injured, and then I had to go home early. So then only once I got back to Scotland, I actually Googled the number, and it was associated to the agent that he claimed to be. So I texted him back, but then that was too late. He didn't want to speak to me, as I was injured goods, damaged goods. And then the following year, just again, no expectation of becoming a professional rugby player, and performed, I suppose, well enough during the 20s campaigns, and then got picked up and out to France.
You're a really humble guy. You say there was no expectation to becoming a professional player. You must at some point been involved in Scottish age groups, thought this is maybe a gig I could get.
Well, I suppose there was. So I was at uni up in Aberdeen playing for Grammar. So I started my second year. That's, yeah, 2013-14 season, uni year. And then I got to Christmas time, and then so the 20 stuff was ramping up. And I did. So I did make the decision to leave uni, hoping that, yeah, if I do give it a good effort, I'd probably have a reasonable chance of maybe picking something up at Edinburgh Glasgow. That was kind of the plan. And then, yeah, well, there's a few opportunities in France arose at the same time and jumped upon one in particular. Yeah.
So that's not really a route then that you would have guessed up, because being in Scotland, you're thinking, I've got one of two options. I either go to Glasgow or I'm in Edinburgh.
Yeah.
So the competition, you know, because Scottish rugby is a village. You know that there's that number of second rows. You know there's that guy in the age group above you and those guys that are already signed. Yeah. So was that part of the modesty, I suppose, about it?
I don't think so. I think just when, so as I say, this agent sort of contacted me during the Six Nations of 2014, saying there was, I think there was four or five French clubs interested. I think because Snoops was our backs coach under 20. So I'm not sure if what sort of timings were, but there must have been a bit of chat about Glasgow, and there potentially been an offer from Glasgow. And then the French clubs, the French teams came out, and then one of them was Toulon. So talking of players around in position, second rows up and down, well, Bakis Botha and Ali Williams were there, so so I couldn't have actually chosen any harder competition, I suppose. But no, it was obviously the opportunity to go and learn from those guys. They were in the last couple of years of their careers, and I was hoping to go out and learn as much as I could from them.
Right, so you've jumped in there, and I need to go with that. So somebody says, right, there's a gig at Toulon. Yeah. You're a lock. You're looking at it going, Bakis Botha. I mean, unbelievable. And Ali Williams, one of the best. Some people would look at that and go, I'm not going because I won't get a game.
Yeah.
I get to learn.
Well, I suppose actually, again, it comes back to maybe being too humble, or I don't know, but it was probably a case of I wasn't really expecting to make it. So it was just a case of, I'll go out, have a bit of a jolly at Toulon, and then if it doesn't work out, at least I do remember that. I signed a 2-year contract, and I remember thinking, if it doesn't work out, at least I'll learn French and I'll have some new friends, and I'll come back to Edinburgh and finish off my studies. So yeah, I mean, it worked out all right in the end.
Well, if we were sitting here now and the story was, Toulon offered, but I went somewhere else, you would always wonder,
I
could have signed with Toulon.
Like, well, 100%. And that's, I remember all my like school friends, again, left school, sort of never expecting to become a professional rugby player. And then, so when I did go out there and do it, I enrolled with boys from school, all football school, Royal High. Well, yeah, traditionally rugby, but when I was there, we struggled for a team. All the football, I'd be like, God, Andy's playing for Real Madrid of rugby. exactly. Imagine someone, a footballer, turned around and had a chance to Real Madrid and turned that down. No, you're quite right. I think if I hadn't done that, I would have regretted it.
So here's Andy. You've never been wee Andy Crammond, but you're walking in to Toulon as Andy Crammond, Scotland under 20 international, ex Aberdeen Grammar, Royal High, to sit down next to Ali Williams and Bakis Botha and the queue of other household names.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you go in shoulders back, chest out, "Hi, I'm Andy Crammond," or do you wait to be spoken to? How does that work? Because if you'd walked into Murrayfield or Scotstoun, you would have known
some of the guys,
at least half of the people that were there.
I think my first morning there, I think there was a lady who used to drive the bus around for the academy guys, so she came and picked me up in the morning, took me down to training centre, and I walked in, and I think it was Ali Williams, Chris Massoy and Carl Heyman were having breakfast at a table. So I think I did just pull up they probably invited me to join them. Oh, I'm sure they did. So, no, I never felt too sort of intimidated, actually, to be honest. And then I would sometimes look at some of the other academy guys and be like frustrated with them not actually, like, being really sort of timid and sort of not speaking. And there were certain times when, obviously, often sort of considered, you know, I would always get, if I buggered up in training, I'd get shouted at by the skateboard, moving on from day one. But it was, if the senior guys would shout at me if I fucked up in training, whereas, and I would always play this sort of situation in my head, whereas what would happen if I shouted at them for fucking up? And there was one time in particular when it was Juan Fernandez Lobe, so yeah, Argentinian lineout coach. I remember I must have missed a lift on him in a preseason game against Stade Français, and then, you know, obviously bollocked me. And then, like, the line out after, I'd read the line out against, I was going to go up and steal it from Parisi, and he never fucking lifted me. So then I'm not sure if he was just getting me back, but obviously I didn't say anything to him, but I was like, I'm thinking back, I was like, I should have fucking gone through him, but that was my time to shine, and you took it from me.
I love that I was going to take it off Parisi, but Fernandez Lobby didn't lift me. You could just throw these names around. But, like, is that intimidating, or were you just, they're my teammates, that's who I'm playing, it's just like it was in that game I played at Grammar, you know, at Lewis Law? Is that just how it was?
Yeah, I think I always, you know, I obviously was sort of intimidating and you'd be nervous. And my first game was in, I got called up actually quite early. I think it was September or so in my first season. I actually got, you know, I was never expecting to play for the first team. I thought, right, I'm getting a chance to train with them, do pre-season with them, but I'll go and play for the academy. And then I think it was maybe mid-September, however many games were in the season, I got called up to play. And then I remember that got on for the last sort of 10 minutes and obviously, don't fuck up. And then, as soon as you make the first tackle, like, obviously you just feel it's just a rugby match. You're in the game. Obviously you're surrounded by a lot of talent, which helps and sort of direct you, keep you in the right place. But no, I mean, yeah, as I say, I've never really felt out of place, thankfully. And I think, well, I put in some decent performances when I got my chances with the first team as well, which helped.
I'm always intrigued when I speak to foreigners that played in France, because there's this French thing of you play really well at home and you win at home, but for some reason when you go away, it just doesn't happen. Yeah. How does that play out as a, you know, is that something you spoke about? Did you and Chris Massoy and Carl Heyman and Ali Williams have a chat about it over breakfast and say, how do we get these boys to realise we can win away from home? Or do you just become part of that culture?
I think you do. I mean, say looking, not that it's ever been discussed, but I suppose me just kind of thinking from their point of view would be that they're used to playing Super Rugby and playing 15 games a year or whatever. And when they come to Europe, then they've got 36 games to play. I suppose some of them, I mean, again, depending on those guys at the end of their careers, like, they kind of welcome a week off when your team's going away to Racing. So I think, I know exactly, and I always thought, oh God, why is it any different for someone, you know, playing home or away? It's just a game of rugby on a rugby pitch, and yeah, the crowd get up at you, and okay, that can help, but also that can help motivate, like, an away team, you know, if the crowd's flying, that helps, that whole atmosphere works both ways. I suppose, as I would go down my career, I guess those weeks off actually were kind of a way it was to rotate the squad and just keep the first team fresh. And I mean, if you can win all your home games, actually you're going to be in a pretty good position at the end of the season. So if you can win those 15 home games, or what, 13 home games, and you can pick up the odds, maybe half of their away, if you can pick up half of your away games, then you're going to be top of the table. Like. So I suppose it is just a tactical way of rotating the squad and then really going after the games that are winnable.
Because, I've only ever been to one game in France, and it was Perpignan at home, and there was no music after the tries, there was no pre-game entertainment. There was no, it was just an electric atmosphere. It was like I'd never been up before. I don't know how many people were there, 15, 18,000. So it wasn't a huge stadium, but it felt like 60,000 in a Turkish football stadium. I mean, it was and it was relentless. What was that like? How did you feel playing and, you know, playing at home? You have that behind you. Is that motivational? Is it intimidating? Is it, I can't make a mistake? Did you relish it? How did it feel play? Because crowds in this country, no matter how hard we try, are never going to be like that.
No, no. Yeah, I think in France, it's, I think the passion for the teams comes from, because it very much is like a, the teams of, apart from Paris teams, okay, Toulouse, but I mean, you still get that same atmosphere at Toulouse. It very much is like, the team of the village, so it's like cast, and it really is. And there's lots like spoken about sort of defending the colours of the town, and everybody buying into that. And so I suppose that passion, and then from like places like Cast and Oyonnax, and not so much Perpignan, because it is a, probably a bit of a nicer place to live, but there's not an awful lot going on in those towns. So like they really buy into rugby. If the rugby team are doing well, like Cast, obviously they've performed amazing and probably one of the best, most consistent teams in the last 10 years. Like, but yeah, as I say, there's not much else for the supporters to get into, so they really buy into that. And what that does on the pitch for myself, I still love it. As I sort of alluded to before, I don't think it was necessarily more of a advantage for the home. Yeah, I wouldn't say so. Like, I enjoyed going away and the fans were mental. It was just cool to be part of. There's that, my debut at Brive, I was on the bench with Dylan Armitage, and I remember that we were in the warm-up area on the dead ball, and he was just getting pelted from the fans. But I don't suppose I wasn't ever the target of the opposing fans, so I don't suppose I got anything too personal. But then, like, that type of person, he would absolutely relish off that. Like, he loves that. That's what he's playing for. Like, he wants that. So, I don't know.
My only Dylan Armitage story was when I was at Murrayfield for Scotland, England, and he started teasing that Scotland had never even been in England's 22, and at that, Ben White scored for Scotland. And he just went from being this cocky to having to shut up and take the stick. But it was class. And those guys, you know, you were still a pup for a lot of that.
I
know Stefan Armitage became somebody you got really close to.
Yeah.
Do you find that the values of those guys at the top of their game are the same as the guys he played with in club rugby in Scotland?
Yeah. I mean, again, it surprised me to, I mean, when I first turned up at Toulon, we were training out of Porter Cabins. you get these like highest paid player lists up here. I think we had six of the top 10 at Toulon and we're changing in Porter Cabins. The physio was in the Porter Cabin. So actually the facilities at Aberdeen Grammar were better than Toulon. So then with that, comes the sort of, the just normal blokes and go out and have beers. Yeah, there was plenty of beers had across my career. I don't know. I think that's a big part of sort of binding teams together, obviously team building and getting to know each other is the beers.
And how did your French develop? Was that something that, being immersed in it came very quickly, or did the international players stick together and enjoy speaking in English?
Naturally the sort of English speaking players would group together. It was just easier at Toulon, because there were so many English speaking guys. There's a team manager called Tom Whitford, who's now with Montpellier. He would translate everything. So there'd be like video sessions. You'd have Bernard Laporte sort of doing his spiel, and then Tom would just instantly translate it, because there was probably half the squad was probably English speaking. So from a sort of 3 years at Toulon, I'm mostly training with the first team, and with Tom translating everything, that kind of did affect my French. I was still kind of conversational, especially with a few beers down there. I could have a chin wag with the boys. And then French, obviously, and then rugby French, so rugby jargon came, that was all right. Then when I moved to Vannes, after I left Toulon, I went up to Vannes in the second division, and there I sort of took a bit more of a, well, what was that, 24 or so, but I sort of started running the line outs and a bit more of a senior player position, and then so I was communicating more with the boys, and the head coach is French, so then I was had more of a relationship with him. So my French sort of probably improved a lot, and then sort of after that first year up at Van.
How are you viewed when you move like that from Toulon to Van? How are you viewed? Is it you're coming from that club? You've got lots to offer us. Are people got a target on your back, and people are trying to knock you over because you've come from the big time? How did that play out?
No, I think in France it's really quite common for the young guys to come out of these top academy programs, and common to drop down into that second division to get a bit of experience. It's only now, well, it's now obviously the French youth players are all that, and the 20s program has been producing some serious players in the last few years. But even in the, I think what kind of the catalyst to that was, like when I was playing, Josh Tuasova was playing espoir rugby, and like he would get the odd game with the first team. He would be, however old was he? He was a year older than me, 20, 21. But you're an espoir player until you're 23. And there's some sort of thing, if you're an espoir player, you're not really trusted, or you're not really given a chance. So like, even though he would come on and score two tries, he would only get to play, and I think his first 2 years, he only played five or six games a season before they really trusted him. So there was a real thing about giving young guys game time. There'd be guys get through to the age of 24 as espoir and then sort of never really played a first team game. Whereas now they've obviously been sort of, there has been more young, and that's with the talent, obviously, when the opportunity comes. They're given a bit more game time in the first teams, which then obviously helps them develop quicker and faster. And then by the time they're playing under 20s, they've played 20 top 14 games. There's no secret bloody recipe. But what was the actual question?
when you go to Van, so you've come down a level, but so. Straight away you're then running the line out. You've got a relationship with the coach. Yeah, you're given much more responsibility. You were ready for it, I suppose, having learned from some of the best.
I think so. So I mean, I learned a lot while I was playing, and then I was playing academy sort of every week, and then the odd occasion I got with the first team, I played well, and it was I sort of took my chance. But again, you just, those chances didn't come sort of. Or they came far and few between. And then when I did drop down that level, obviously a bit of a lower level in the second division, first turned up, it wasn't instantly into the line-out role, but then the guy that was running the line-outs, I sort of felt as if I could do a better job probably. So I had that discussion with the coach, and then sort of was entrusted with it, which then helped my confidence and my skills. Obviously, you need to be making these decisions of line-outs under pressure and in game environments. And at senior rugby, it's different level to the academy stuff. So I think being entrusted with that role really did help. And then with the game time, I think in that first year I played, I think one of the most amount of minutes in the team. Which then again, there's no secret recipe. The more rugby you play, the better you get.
So, hello all Happiness is Egg Shape listeners and watchers. This is the Happiness Is podcast with me, your host, Bruce Aitchison, brought to you in association with Infinity Blue. They can look after you whether it is a checkup, teeth whitening, or a more complicated procedure. Give them a call, get in touch, and they will look after you to make sure that you keep that smile intact. Because after all, they know, we know, I know, you know, happiness is egg shaped. How, when you drop down, are you still that top 14 player? You're just playing, were you as fit playing in the second tier as you were in the top tier? Did you feel like your performances were the same, or is it just how it goes that maybe there's a bit less?
Yeah. Again, it comes down to the game time, I think. Yeah, I mean, I felt really fit. I actually had that pre-season before I went to Van. I don't know, I think I've spoken about this before, but I was supposed to go from Toulon to Pau. Well, I did go to Pau for the last 6 months of my 3 years at Toulon. And I was supposed to have a contract there, so all promised to me. And whatever happened, that fell through with a week or two before I was supposed to go back for pre-season. So I actually did my pre-season at Gloucester. And then that got, yeah. So I was very, when I turned up at Van in September, just after the start of the season, I was as fit as I've ever been. And I sort of took that through that first season, and I was flying. And it probably dropped off a little bit in the second, third season, just sort of French culture comes back into probably too many beers, too many baguettes. I was still performing really well. I mean, my whole career aesthetically, I wasn't the most pleasing on the eye, my love handles. But no, I was fitness level GPSs and things. Like, I was always in pre-season, I was always up. I was up at the top. I would just piss off the conditioning coaches that I didn't like the part.
So there's two stereotypes that we have of rugby in France, and I'll give you them both, but I'll give you them one at a time. The first one is, especially in those lower tiers, there's this feeling that it's really dirty, it's really physical, there's lots of things going on, there's no place for the weak or the soft that you're found out really quickly. Is that true?
I suppose so. I always remember, I think the Pro League is for some reason like branded as the most physical league in the world, but I mean, it's not. Look at the collisions in the top 14, and well, never mind. Yeah, even the URC and the Premiership. Like, no, it's not. This, I don't know how they define that most physical. I think it's probably the amount of time doing mauling and scrumming, and which isn't the real physicality. It's the big contacts that you see with the top athletes. The dirtiness, yeah, certainly when I first started at Van, there was a few of the old school was still kicking about. And there was one guy in particular, I don't actually know his name, but he played for Colomia. He was the number four for Colomia. And he had fair hair and a headband. And I remember once he got sent off for just going up to someone and just smacking him. And then I was getting tagged. So Colomia playing blue as well, so I was playing at Van the time. And then I was getting tagged all over Twitter by my friends being like, Andy, what the hell have you done? Thinking it was me, I just got up and smacked someone. I was like... So I don't know. I wasn't sure which way to play it. Like, to be like, oh yeah, I'm the tough guy, or just I denied it was me. But no, there was certainly that aspect of it. And then even the division below, like Federal One, or the teams that were around Toulon, particularly the team called La Seine, and there was always once a season at least there was a video would come out of La Seine, and it was a fight was starting the pitch, and then the supporters were all involved. And but with cameras nowadays, like, you can't. Even now, cameras are now, all the games are filmed in the third division. So I don't think not too much of that naughtiness happens anymore.
Not anymore. The other one is, and you've kind of, maybe you've mentioned it there, is the decisions are made on the whim of an owner or a, so, right, you've lost, you're not getting paid tomorrow, or, you know, your contract, I've ripped it up, you can go. Is that, surely that's an old-fashioned, outdated myth.
Potentially outdated now, yeah. But well, I did have an experience, well, not personally, but I witnessed Toulon. Yeah, I think that's what the famous stories come out of Toulon with all the owner having a huff. What Joanne Smith, there was once we turned up for training in the morning, like on payday or the day after payday, and he'd only received half his wage. So he just said to the forwards coach, the forwards coach didn't speak any English and Juan didn't speak any French. So he just got up shouting to the room saying, right, I'm off. I've only been paid half my salary. So, and the forwards coach kind of laughing, going, where's Juan going? And we were like, oh, he's going home. He's not been paid. So then the coach, Jacques, went through to Mourad's and obviously told him what was happening. And then we had an afternoon session and Joanne was back in the afternoon. He'd been paid. Which then, yes, again, I sort of, you know, after the fact would be, you know, if that happened to me, if I'd only been paid half my wage and I got up and walked out the video, I wonder what would happen. We'd probably been told not to come back.
Yeah, you weren't there in the afternoon. You were allowed to go. No.
Yeah, yeah.
So one of my favourite stories about you being in France, and I need to know if this is true, because my jealousy level could hit an all-time high. You got to have a bit of a kick about in France, didn't you? You got to play a bit of football.
Yeah.
Against?
Well, yeah, I know where this is going. Yeah, we played against the 1998 World Cup winning French team, including Zidane, Robert Pires. Unfortunately, Barthez wasn't there.
Right, talk me through how Andy Crammond for Edinburgh gets to play against the World Cup winning 1998 French team featuring Zidane, Perret. How did that happen?
The champ, yeah. That was being part of the Real Madrid of rugby, I suppose you get opportunities, don't you? I think the year before that they'd played Marseille, and Cantona had been playing for Marseille. And then it was part of a children's charity. The name escapes me. It was part of a children's charity that they'd organise these games to raise money. And yeah, we've played against that team. I've got Zidane's shorts in my cupboard somewhere. I managed to get a pair of shorts off him. I did ask for a strip, but his strips have been donated to children's charity, so I thought I better let that slide.
You scored though, didn't you?
I did. And I regret not having some mad celebration, some forward roll and some Tim Cahill style. The archer. I don't know if it was a corner or just a cross. And then it was headed on, popped up in the air, and we volley into the bottom corner. Yeah, my only regret is it wasn't Bart.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
There's a goal. That would have been pretty cool if I said I scored against Barthez. As a Man U fan.
So how many people were there? What stadium were you in? That is incredible.
Very, very fortunate circumstances. It was just at Mayol at the home ground in Toulon. I don't know how many people, 10,000 or so. It was in pre-season 1 year. It must have just been, I think, on the Friday or something, so maybe the end of the week we run around. Played half football and then half touch. We weren't allowed to tackle Zidane.
what were they like at touch? Was there anybody you looked at and thought they could cut this?
No, not really. I don't think they didn't. I mean, yeah, obviously they've got they're all 40, 45, however old, 50, they're all quite. So the athleticism had maybe gone a little bit there. Trying to pass the ball was a bit tough.
Yeah,
but Zidane, I think we did allow. I think there's a good clip of like Dylan, I think, letting Zidane through to score a try on the posts. And he got a length of the pitch try.
you would do that for Zidane. That's
exactly
quite cool.
Exactly. God can do what he wants.
Yeah. So you're
in that part of France. Yeah.
You must have been thinking, you must have been pinching yourself at moments like that.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. Well, I think, yeah, go back to that. I think I've said this before. It's a gen- or, there's stories of, I think, Montpellier, was it? When Jim Hamilton, I think he tells it, when he turned up and the president looked at me and said, "Who the fuck are you?" He thought he'd signed Richie Gray. And then, you know, Richie Gray was playing really off Scotland at the time, and he thought he was signing the big lock from Scotland. But yeah, I mean, a similar, yeah, sort of, you felt as if surely they didn't want, why have they signed me? Like, surely I'm not supposed to be here. I'm going to get found out soon enough. But no, I'm bad for that. I mean, I was good. Yeah, I played well enough. I was obviously, I earned my place there, and I shouldn't put myself down so much.
So when you were playing in France, you playing well, feeling fit, what was the ambition? Were you just dealing with the next job, or was there a, there's what I would like to do, I want to win that trophy, I want to go and play there? Yeah. International honours must have come into your head at some point.
Yeah, of course. So yeah, when I was playing, I mean, I played that first year at Van, and I think I was in like team of the year, and then so kind of from then I was like, right, I need to get back to the top 14. And then there was every year there's chat, and then also in, I can't remember what orders they came in, but between Edinburgh and Glasgow there was sort of each year there was some chat and something was going to happen and things didn't work out and couldn't come to an agreement. And then yeah, I kind of that, as you say, it was going through all of this, and what was part of decisions was sort of my head, and I was sort of did struggle with concussions throughout my career. So I was always kind of aware that I wasn't going to be playing until I was 35. So when we look back at, you know, we look back to what we were saying before and saying I would have always regretted the opportunity of going, I would have always regretted not going to Toulon. I did want to come back to Edinburgh, Glasgow, and sort of give it a final shot of getting a Scotland cap, and sort of with the thought of being, I don't want to stop and sort of look back and not have given it a go, not have given it my best shot. And we were pretty close to that happening, whenever that was, after COVID. But yeah, again, just sort of things fizzled out, and then I was being pressured by Beerus. I think I was having to wait for Edinburgh, and then I think I was being pushed by Beerus for an answer, so I ended up having to just sort of sign at Beerus. And then the goal, in terms of my head, it was right, once I get back to top 14, or if I play for Scotland, then I can kind of then probably retire in a bit of peace. So yeah, I managed to get back up to top 14, and then unfortunately, yeah, I played sort of 5 games that season, and then was sort of told to stop by the doctors.
So we'll come back to that a bit, but how does it work? I'm always intrigued when players talk the way you've spoken about there, that we spoke to them, it didn't quite work. How does it work? Are you speaking? Is your agent speaking on your behalf? Are you going together? Is it done, you know, at that time, I'm imagining Zoom and phone calls and emails. How does it actually work to somebody like me that's never been involved in it, and people that are listening or watching? What is that process?
Yeah, I mean, it's done through the agents. My agent was Jamie Noon throughout sort of most of my career, ex-England player. And yeah, most of the chats sort of done through him. The odd time you'd get, if you had a relationship with coaches, you would get sort of a personal phone call. That happened a couple of times from guys I played. Well, when I went to Poole, it was Carl Heyman that gave me a call just directly. Or there would be kind of workarounds where, I forget his name, Richard Cockrell's right-hand man, whatever his name was. He was good mates with one of the guys I was playing with at Van, so he was obviously able to speak to Dan about me and sort of get some references, and then there was a bit of chat through that. But then ultimately it does then come back to the agent, and it's up to him to then negotiate sort of on my behalf and lay out the options I've got, and then ultimately it is my decision to sort of which way go, if these all these options are still on the table. As I say, it sort of came down, Edinburgh asked me to wait a little bit longer, but I needed to sort myself out. I had to give an answer to Beerus, so unfortunately, yeah, that never quite happened.
you do it because you loved it. Did it feel like a job at points where you thought, where's my next wage coming from? Or were you just still riding a bit of a wave?
Yeah, obviously, I'm very fortunate to be playing rugby for a living. But by the end, with my head as a consideration as well, and sort of what that looks like going forward, that came into it. And yeah, okay, I was getting paid well to do something that I love doing, I would be doing anyway. But then with the concussion stuff, it was ultimately just, well, it doesn't really matter about the money, so I just need to look after my health. And that was the final decision which made me stop, is I need to look forward and for the rest of my life. It's only a small part of my life, this 10-year period. I was enjoying it, but as I say, I think so my last game was against Leon in the top 14, and I remember going into that game not really wanting to be there, because I already knew that I was one game away from the doctor told me if I have one more, like he'd call it. So I suppose it's always that when you're trying to avoid an injury, you never feel committed, and that's when you're most likely to get injured. And so I suppose by the end, like in training, if we'd ever be doing sort of contact drills, I was not interested. I wasn't going to put my head into something, risk getting my last one in training. And then that ultimately sort of transferred into games. And I probably wasn't as fully committed as I should have been and or could have been. Called it a day. I was forced to call it a day, but I did agree with that decision. Yeah.
I can't imagine what that's like, having to make that decision. Did you speak to 5 or 6 people that are close to you and they all said yeah, or were you just clear in your own mind, this is me, it's my decision, it's my life, it's my career, yeah, I'm going to make this call?
As I said before, I knew I was never going to be playing to 35. I knew it was a matter of time. It was tough in that last game. I think the game before we had played Toulouse, and the week before, and there was a couple of times when I was thinking, right, have I had a knock there? Should I go off? I didn't, kind of knowing that that would have been in my career, and I kind of pushed that. And then, as I say, this following week against Leon, turning up in the game, I remember opening the door to walk into the tunnel, and I just remember kind of thinking, like, I don't want to be here. So when, after about 20 minutes, I got big Roman Telfafuna's head on head, I went down, and the doctor came over, and I then was like, that's me. Walked off, obviously, there was a few tears in the changing room. But yeah, ultimately it was kind of my decision. The doctors, it was a funny one, because I kind of knew then, I'd already been told by the doctor, right, if you have one more, you're done. But then it was kind of a delayed process, which probably made things a bit harder. I had to go through quite a few sort of hoops and go through a few steps to then actually get officially sort of told that I was retired, that I was having to retire. Whereas I knew deep down, like I'd already kind of made that decision, I suppose. And then I needed a doctor to actually just say definitively, right, you are stopped. Cause then that just took all sort of doubt out of my head. There was a bit of chat to suggest, oh, there's a possibility you could, go do some tests, and there's a possibility you could get back. Which then kind of gave me a bit of hope, dangled the wee carrot. But then I also, cause I saw multiple doctors, so that one of them was giving me this wee carrot. And then at first I sort of jumped on that, and I was like, all right, maybe I can get back. And then ultimately, I think that actually was causing me sort of like, I was becoming like anxious about that, and like anxious about sort of going back out on the pitch and getting more concussions. And so in the end, I just needed that sort of definitive answer to be like, right, you're done, time to move on. And then people say, do you miss rugby? And I'm like, yeah, I do. I miss the times, I miss the coffees, and I miss the banter. I didn't have an option but to stop it for my future and for the health. And so, yeah, I don't know.
I suppose there comes a point where if you're trying too hard to justify it,
it's the right decision. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Exactly.
And just one final point on this. Is there Have you had much chat to Carl Heyman around this topic?
I know, I've not actually. I know, I don't really know why I've not reached out to him. I don't know. I think I'm just kind of hoping I've stopped early enough compared to those guys of that sort of generation. Suppose, yeah, that's probably in a bit of fear that I don't really want to speak to those guys about it all. But yeah, I mean, I know their stories. I remember him sort of talking about, I've seen the stuff that's going around. So as I say, I think I have, and hopefully I've just stopped early enough that, yeah, don't need to go there.
But you look back, I mean, I've watched from afar. I've known you for not quite 10 years,
since
maybe.
Since I was at school. Well, no, I think, yeah, probably. I think when you were at Murrayfield, I was playing at Royal High. You were coaching Murrayfield, Wanderers.
Yeah, so maybe it is. So I've known you for a long time, and I always loved, as I said in the intro, I just loved watching it from afar, and that feeling of you going out and doing something that was outside the norm of go through an academy, get a contract, earn some cash. I loved that, watching you away, and then every now and then I'd get a, you know, there'd be a video of you, or I'd see a picture of you doing something, and there was a massive amount of pride that you were doing that. Can you look back now with pride, or is it still too close? Are you going to give yourself some time before you start saying, actually, that was quite cool?
Yeah, no, of course. Yeah, I do. Yeah, I don't need to remind myself. I do remind myself. I know that I was very fortunate in sort of the path I went. It was different. And I know a lot of the guys that stay in Scottish rugby sort of probably look at me or look back at me and sort of say, we maybe should have done that kind of. But then also, then what we kind of alluded to, in hindsight, I don't know, I did miss out on that calf. I'll look at some of the guys that have sort of played, and I might feel as if I could have got a couple of caps at least. But then also, remind myself again that I've had an amazing 9 years in France and had experiences that nobody else had, and a house down in Biarritz. And yeah, I mean, if I'd gone to Glasgow, well, I remember that was one day, this kind of probably peaks it, this probably tops it all off. One day when I was out on a yacht in Saint-Tropez, we'd seen Ronaldo on the port, and I were out on the yacht going to, and then I remember saying, I think I said to some of the boys, it was with some of the Aussie guys, and I remember saying, it's like, you know, I could have been a boat in the Clyde here, whereas I'm on a yacht and the Mediterranean off Central Bay. So yeah, I suppose that probably sums up the decision quite well.
Yeah, I can imagine a few people willing that. Did your mate Ashy give you a shout to go and join him in LA? Was there ever the thought of, I could do a bit in America or a bit in Japan, or I could...
Well, yeah. Certainly, as I say, sort of when the head knock stuff sort of started coming into decisions at the end of my career, I never really explored it. I'd spoken to one agent who was based out of Australia, had a lot of players in Japan, and he said I would have no bother getting a contract. They're always looking for second rows. And I did think that just sort of the contact was probably lesser in Japan, but we never quite got to that point. You know, I never got through my last contract. So maybe at the end, if I'd lasted to the end of that contract, I might have tried to get out to Japan. And I would have loved to go to America, but yeah, unfortunately, that didn't happen.
Yeah, Ash, you'll have a few stories to tell you, I've no doubt.
No, exactly.
Hello, all Happiness is Eggshaped listeners and watchers. This is the Happiness Is podcast with me, your host, Bruce Aitchison, brought to you in association with Infinity Blue. They can look after you whether it is a checkup, teeth whitening, or a more complicated procedure. Give them a call, get in touch, and they will look after you to make sure that you keep that smile intact. Because after all, they know... We know, I know, you know, happiness is egg-shaped. When you talk about you missing the coffees, missing the thing I miss, and didn't give up for the reasons you get, but when I stopped playing, the thing I miss more than ever, and I've been a coach for a long time, but you're never a player, is the changing room. And before, you know, I know clubs now have their social media guy in the corner taking videos of them and all that kind of stuff. But the changing room, when there's no cameras, it's just the team, the coaches, maybe the medical, but it's a closed environment. It's just yours. How precious was that to you?
No, yeah, that is special. And yeah, I suppose you kind of take it for granted. Yeah, while you're in there. So looking back, you know, it is strange to sort of think that is somewhere you'll never be again. That's when I say the coffee, I kind of mean that whole just being with the boys, no matter if it's in the cafe or if it's in for a pre-match in a game or the celebrations after a game, which are amazing experiences that, as you say, nobody else can say they've experienced. I'll miss it, but yeah, no, I'm not too much. I can move on.
If a kid came to you, you're now back in Edinburgh, a young player comes to you and said, you know, you went away, what do you think I should do? What sort of advice would you give somebody now, an 18, 19, 20-year-old who's, you know, maybe decided opportunities in Scotland are not going to offer themselves up to them? What sort of advice would you give a young player?
Yeah. No, I'd certainly advise them to go away to a foreign country. And that doesn't have to be France. It's France or Italy or Japan or America. And it's not New Zealand. Yeah, go to bloody New Zealand. That's probably the best piece of advice I'd say. And because at 20, you're still young. Like, although we're seeing guys breaking through at 18, 19 now, like 20, you're still bloody young. So if you can go to New Zealand and learn from the best and improve your rugby, then I'd certainly do that. And it's experiences outside of rugby. What's the All Blacks saying? It's a better men make better All Blacks or something. So it's certainly that piece of advice would be just go and try and grow as a person. And the advantage of going to French or France or Italy or Spain, is learning that second language was a huge life skill. I'd definitely recommend young guys getting away, learning a new different environment, different culture.
We've mentioned you're humble, you're reasonably relaxed, you've played down a lot of these things that have happened. Was there points where you were really uncomfortable? Because you've taken yourself to an environment that you didn't know anything about.
No.
With people, although you'd seen on TV, I mean, even that brings its own, you know, intimidation. It's a foreign country, it's a different language. You know, sometimes I go on holiday and I feel like I'm being taken advantage of because I don't understand what's going on. I mean, you were a kid.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I think I just rolled with the punches and just bounced about and got on with it. I remember my first night in my flat, I got dropped off by Jamie. It was my previous agent. But I got dropped off and the flat was literally empty. There was no duvet or pillows or anything. I remember thinking, what the F am I doing here? Like, take me home. Didn't have any Wi-Fi, no friends. That was probably, sort of my lowest. And then I moved on from there. Yeah, there was a few challenges throughout, peaks and troughs. But no, I never really felt too uncomfortable. And I think that's kind of just the way I am. Yeah, I like to go out and meet new people and talk to new people. And yeah, which is why I'm sort of doing what I'm doing now is, it's about just chatting to people and meeting new people.
It cracks me up because you've had that. I've had 9 years in France. I've done that. I've played football against Zidane. And now I'm back in Edinburgh. I'm a month married. I've got a new job. You know, it must feel like it was somebody else in a different world. Life.
Well, yeah. Well, exactly. That's it. Sometimes if I'm meeting someone today who doesn't know who I am, I say, oh, yeah, what have you been doing before? I'm a professional rugby player. And obviously. I had a wall decorator in and he's sort of telling me, one of my mate's friends plays in France. I think he plays a pretty high level. And I could tell by the way he was talking to me, he just presumed I must have just played rugby in France. Yeah. And then he did name the guy. And then I knew that was a pub league. And then, I can't remember if I actually told, I don't think he would have known if I said I played for Toulon. He wouldn't have known what that meant. But yeah, there's certainly people that, you tell them and it's surprise, very surprised of what I might have done before.
So you've got that experience. You've been a line out leader. You've become an experienced player. I know that you're dabbling in coaching, but are you still a supporter? Do you still like watching the game? Would you be seen on the touchline watching an amateur game? Will you go and watch Scotland or Edinburgh and Glasgow?
Yeah, no, certainly will. Coaching, obviously, watching the Aki's games. I plan to watch Scotland games this Saturday, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, watch that, Scotland, Italy. Have I been down to Murrayfield? I don't think I've been to Murrayfield to watch a game yet. I think I did. I went to Murrayfield. I was on the pitch for the first time at the Eagles concert. Now that was quite tough. I remember being there, obviously unrelated to rugby, but then thinking, God, this is my time on the pitch. But I'm watching the Eagles. God's sake! yeah. What were we saying?
Yeah. Can you watch as a supporter, or are you picking apart the line out? Yeah. Are you thinking, oh, I can see he's got a little tail there?
Yeah, I did think of that. I was kind of going to mention that before. Something I do miss is that sort of, I'll see that and I want to take that. And I'm struggling with that in coaching. It's like, can I tell the guys to do something which, yeah, I can see it's sort of obvious, but from the side, everything's easier from the sideline. But I want to just go in and just do it. I just want to go in and do it. So I do struggle a bit with that. And then I miss sort of the feeling of, you know, making a line break and hearing the crowd, hearing the 10,000 at Raven Place screaming your name.
When I watch as a coach, there are little bits of the line out, right? I've never jumped in a line out, been in a line out. But when the throw goes in, I'll go up on my tiptoes as if that's helping the jumper get to the peak of the jump. Or do you have little moments like that?
Yeah. Oh, certainly. Yeah, because I mean, I can tell. I know the way the ball's come out of his hands. I know if it's gonna hit the jumper or not. So yeah, you can. Well, there's a bit of a sell, but you can see where the defence is standing and you go, oh, why have you called that? but no, certainly, you've got the sort of left and right. Someone's running around and you're trying to dodge the defence for them. No, I think that'll always, and I think that's with all white rugby. Even my dad, I would say, not that he's probably coached me at mini rugby, but I'd say him watching rugby, I think he'd still be doing that. I think all rugby lovers are doing that to the TV. Throwing their slippers at the TV when England score.
I know some people like that. When you reflect back, let's pick some names here. Who was a really good teammate? Not necessarily the best player, but who did you really love being teammate with?
There was a guy called Beeritz. Yeah, probably unknown to you and your audience. A guy called Adam Knight, who was picked up by Beeritz from. He was sort of in the Otago and the Highlanders Academy in New Zealand. And then he was just a grafter. Loved his video analysis. So then helped me in the lineouts, and he'd come and speak to me in the lineouts, and having maybe seen something, or come and ask questions if he needed a bit of help. And then just, worked bloody hard and was a tough bugger. He was probably one of the best teammates. You start naming people and you forget people. It's not fair. the older guys at Toulon that looked after me and gave me the experiences that I was able to. Sort of Drew Mitchell and Stephen Armitage in particular. They're very generous to me. A little academy player that couldn't do what they were doing day to day, but they would sort of take me along for the ride. But yeah, that's more of a sort of just a friend. That wasn't even so much teammate. Yeah.
Who's the best storyteller? Who would you listen to?
What is going on here? Something's vibrating around, sorry. Best storyteller? Me.
listen to yourself. I'm not going to let you back that one up with anybody else. Who's the funniest? Who's your funniest teammate? Who did you love laughing at and being with?
Oh, for God's sake, this is tough. No, I mean, there's loads of people that, yeah, and I'll just, I can't think of any of these names. I probably got up to no good with a guy called George Stokes, who I played in the academy with at Toulon. We had a lot of fun together. He's now playing, he's actually like a Spanish, he's not played international. He lives in Spain, Villarreal. They won the double Spain this year. He's George Stokes, he's English, but grew up in Spain. He was actually in the Academy of Glasgow for a year, but he was a funny bugger, and had a lot of fun together.
Good, I like that. Right, last one before I give you the one I told you about before. How well can Scotland do in the World Cup?
I think they can sit in, well, I mean, we've shown their past performance the past couple of years. They're really building and they're building to hopefully to a peak, but it is a bloody tough pool that they find themselves in, isn't it? As usual, as ever. But like, there's no reason why not. They've obviously pushed the beaten England. They've pushed the All Blacks for a couple of years ago. They've beaten all the top teams. So why not on their day? They could certainly cause a few upsets.
Okay, well done. That was good media training. I like that. Jeez, you sit on the fence there, my man. After all that, that's what you're giving me. Yeah, they'll be all right. Okay, right. So thank you. I've loved it. It's been brilliant to see you. It's good to see you looking so fit. Although you're one of those annoying buggers that's given up. I was hoping you were going to balloon, but you've actually got even fitter since you stopped playing rugby. So for you, Andy, happiness is.
Freedom of time, do what you want with your time and spend it with who you want to spend your time with.
Geez, you've got wise in your old age. I like that. I'm going to use that one. Andy, I've absolutely loved it. Enbrakis are really lucky to have you there imparting a bit of your knowledge and experience, and I'm sure the players will benefit from it, and hopefully I'll see you very soon.
Yeah, no, certainly will. Maybe get a beer up town one day.
Nice. I like the sound of that. We've done that once before, but that's a story for another day.
Yeah. Volume 2.
Good man. Good to see you.
Right. Cheers, Bruce. Enjoyed.
Absolutely loved that. What a top man. So many stories to tell. Unique and definitely worth a listen. So if you've enjoyed it, you can catch us on Apple, Acast and Spotify. You can watch on Facebook and YouTube. Tell your friends. Leave us a review. We're back, as you can see. The backdrop has changed, the location has changed, but it's still the same nonsense. And unfortunately, I've not got any fitter, but we're working on it. I look forward to seeing you all again very, very soon with some more guests. But in the meantime, my name is Bruce Aitchison from the Happiness Is podcast, and my happiness is egg-shaped. Hello all Happiness is Egg-shaped listeners and watchers. This is the Happiness Is podcast with me, your host, Bruce Aitchison, brought to you in association with Infinity Blue. They can look after you whether it is a checkup, teeth whitening, or a more complicated procedure. Give them a call, get in touch, and they will look after you to make sure that you keep that smile intact. Because after all, they know, we know, I know, you know, happiness is egg-shaped.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices.
Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.